I've seen a death proof, but I haven't seen the actual book.
You haven't seen your book yet?
No, one's always the last to know.
Why? But don't you send her a stack of books?
I assume so.
Well, any publisher send you stacks of books and it's chapters. No.
It's been out in Illinois, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, it has. Heinemann, yes, it has. Heinemann? Yes, it has. Heinemann, yes. No, I have seen many, many of those.
When did it come out in England?
Where are we now?
About a year.
November. November. In time for Christmas.
I was reading the book and I thought to myself, and this is before I read any of the publicity material, the quotes, the literature, and all this stuff. And I'm reading along The Hearts and Lives of Men, and I said, gosh, you know, this is almost like Charles Dickens. I said, I'm going to ask her about that. And when she comes in, I see there are quotes, and this was actually done in parts and things, yes, the way Dickens did. So tell me a little bit how this story evolved.
Well, I didn't know.
Unfortunately, this was not an original observation. I was going to on that.
Well, it came as rather a shock to me to discover it was like Dickens. I didn't know about it. I'm not a great Dickens fan, actually. Fortunately, I suppose, or unfortunately, depending on how you take to the book. I mean, my agent is, and suggested to me one day that I write a serial for Woman's Magazine. And that's not the kind of thing you really ought to do if you want to keep your literary respectability, is it?
So you actually did this in parts?
So I did in parts. I wrote it in 48 parts. I didn't know how long it was going to go on, nor I discovered to Dickens. You just go on writing till the day the editor says that's enough of that.
But it seems like such a well-drawn plot because everything is tied up at the end. It doesn't seem you had done this
in this way. It was constructed. You have to construct a story that you can bring to an end in about 3 episodes, which is all the notice they can give you, usually, you see. Well, that's what they say. And so you have to go back in time. I mean, this is the way it you just have to construct it. This is why you discover most of Dickens' novels are about children. If you're writing like that, there is no other way you can bring it up to the present day except by going back in the past. And since time is the most difficult thing for a writer to control, really, this is the only way you discover it can be done.
What magazine did it appear in?
Glad you asked me that question. It was Woman or Woman's Own.
I'm sorry, it was what?
Lotcher knows. It was Woman.
It was called Woman?
The magazine was called Woman.
Woman.
And it's a mass market, mass circulation magazine for women filled with advice about how to wash your knickers and what cream to put on your face. But it has some good fiction. And since it seemed to me that we were in such a ambiance, you might as well fill your novel with advice and homilies and good words and instructions on how to live, which indeed is what the book has, I discover reading it.
Now, you say that the story was in 48 parts?
Yes.
And the magazine comes out how often?
Every week.
Every week, so it ran for almost a year.
Yes, it ran for almost a year, and every week I would write an episode, and I would write it on the train. I live in Somerset and have an office in London and come up there quite a lot. So, and I would come up on Thursdays and I had to deliver the episode on Thursdays, so I would write the episode on the train on the way up. Sometimes I'd take Wednesdays as well, I do admit. And the messenger would be at the door and we would get it typed and altered and edited, and off it would go to the magazine, who I think had no idea that we were actually doing it like this. I really think they thought I had written the whole thing and was just dividing it up into bits for them and sending it off. I mean, it is no way to write a serial novel. Serious novel, but a serial novel, I said. And in a way, that's what it is. But it works, so
indeed it does. Now, the book itself, of course, each part is very short. Some of them are just a couple of pages. Is the book divided into 48 chapters as well, or did you make structural changes?
No, I made some structural changes.
How did the book change?
Well, it didn't change at all. Mostly because a lot of the episodes were short, I had to make them a bit longer and link them up with rather more sophistication than I had. But the overall structure is the same. That is a whole series of cliffhangers, which I loved writing. I think the reason the book has this energies is because I just loved writing it like that. I thought it was the best fun I've ever had writing anything.
Absolutely, and it makes you want to go on, find what happens next, like the old Saturday morning movie serials that I used to see when I was a kid. Now, you state a philosophy, in a way, in the hearts and lives of men, and this has something to do with coincidence. And, of course, in this book, there is a lot of coincidence. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, it's one of the fictional rules, really, that you should not use coincidence. It seems as cheating. But real life is full of coincidences, at least mine is. It's all these people who suddenly turn up out of the blue. You meet them on an empty beach in a far-off land, and it's somebody you went to school with. Life is full of these things. I always feel there is some sort of wheels within wheels, and all our lives are in some way interconnected. Well, if you're writing a serial, you can actually put some truth into it. In most effective novels, you pull back from your real experience all the time. Real experience is actually much... when they say truth is stranger than fiction, it certainly is, but that's only because the writers of fiction don't allow themselves to be as absurd or bizarre as the truth, because that's not what people want. The difficulty with coincidence in real life, I think, is that it appears random. The person you meet on the beach, you don't really see quite why you met them on the beach. People read fiction, I'm sure. I mean, it's a funny thing to do when you think of it, but I think people read fiction in order to get some kind of shape or meaning to their lives so that they feel experience is not random, which is why they tend not to like it in fiction. But in this book, I got away with it.
You also got away with it because the book is very funny and very witty, and there are parts where you could just stop and laugh hilariously. Can't do that if you're talking about a very, very serious book with all sorts of sinister, fatal implications.
Yes, it has. It has its sinister and gothic moments. But I think, you see, also, if you write like that, it tends to reflect what you're feeling that week. And some weeks everything looks really extremely funny, and other weeks it looks really dire. And that, I think, gets into the book as well. So if you read it, I suppose you get a closer view of a writer's mind or a writer's life, almost, or the changing frames of mind than you do in more formally constructed and written novels.
Now, there's a lot about the art world in your novel. Do you yourself have an association with the art world?
Well, only
a... Or are you an observer?
My husband paints pictures, so I know.
Not like John Lally, I trust. I mean, his John, of course, was a kind of a crazy artist at the beginning, although he shapes up toward the end.
Yeah, he certainly shapes up, yes. He's Metropolitan Museum is full of his terrible paintings. No, he's a friend. He's not my husband.
I'm sorry?
I said he is. I can say that because I'm in a strange country. He's somebody I... based on somebody I know who actually isn't a painter, but if you put that person, turn that genius, if you like, into a painter, you get John Lally.
Tell me about some of the other characters. There's, of course, we all like Helen and we all like Nell. Clifford, I was ambivalent about, and Angie, of course, you make not very appetizing. But Clifford bothered me a lot because the narrator makes direct and specific references to liking Clifford, and yet Clifford doesn't come off as well as he might.
Well, no, he's a horrible piece of work, really, but I like him. I don't admire my friends. I just like them. A lot of my friends are really, truly terrible people, but I don't like them or dislike them because of that. Do you choose your friends because you admire their qualities?
Well, no. You admire friends because of the way you relate to them.
Yes, well, I, as a writer, related pretty well to Clifford. But I do keep having to excuse him and explain to the reader that actually I do like him and he's likable, because I find it rather difficult to explain this, I suppose.
But in general, the men don't come off as well as the women.
Well, no, all
except
men.
Angie, of course, comes off badly, but most
well,
of the
Angie,
women...
Yes, Angie comes off badly, because she gets squashed by a lorry, doesn't she, in the end. which overturns
well, that's not
squashes
why she comes off badly.
No, but I like her too. She is really horrible, but she can't help it. But all the men in my box are perfectly horrible anyway. At least, they're not. They just behave like men do in real life. That is to say, they're awful but likable. I mean, why else do we associate with them? They behave badly. I don't have heroes, nor indeed anti-heroes. I think my men are more like real life, perhaps, than the women are. But men are accustomed to seeing themselves as heroes in novels, and it's slightly surprising to them, indeed shocking, when they discover that they're not central, but somehow slightly on the sidelines. In fact, the women behave much worse. Helen, my heroine, behaves quite appallingly. Faithless, miserable, self-pitying, all kinds of passive, all kinds of awful things.
You say men are like this. They behave badly in real life, but I wonder if that's actually true. It just seems to me, from my observation, I don't know that much about men, but it seems to me, or women either, but it seems to me that men are just more vivid characters than most women are.
Well, I just look at the divorce rates, really, and I look at the number of unsupported children there are in the world, and I decide that men are a faithless, abandoning lot.
Okay, all right. Well, now tell me a little bit about your writing style. This was particularly amusing because it's almost Victorian writing, where you will say, "Listen, dear reader, I'd like to tell you this." That does take a risk, doesn't it?
It seems to me perfectly appropriate in some novels and in this kind of novel. Now, you can't get away from it. I'm a writer, you're a reader. Let's just admit it. I'm telling you a story. I hope you will go on reading it week by week. Therefore, I will take you by the scruff of your neck and shake you to make you pay attention, because I think it is very good for you to read this book. So that's what I do. I don't do it in all novels. I don't think I will do it again. I think readers probably prefer the kind of novel in which you build a total illusion and let them make their own way within this structure that you've created. But it's nice having this direct relationship with the reader. It's nice imagining them out there and actually writing to them, and it's amusing. And what's more, you see, once you get a name as a writer, and once you have got a face as a writer, which is what publishers these days like you to have, so I do a lot of television work at home, and they know who you are, it seems more honest almost to say, "This is me writing you a novel," than to pretend to be this authorial, godlike figure who knows everything and who's judgment and decisions are always going to be right. I like to be argued with. I mean, I want my reader to argue with me. I put forward the most extraordinary propositions sometimes and try it out besides, and I want them to come back in their heads and say that this is absurd. How can you know this 3-year-old girl floating down from the skies and in the only survivor of a plane crash because of some aeronautical trick that keeps the back of the aircraft afloat. This is absurd. This is going too far. I want my reader to feel that and yet sort of be on my side and with me and accept it. And you know, we've got to get it there, her there somehow for reasons of the plot, so let's just accept it and then let's just get on with it, you see.
But your narrator, who is your narrator?
Well, the narrator is a kind of fictionalized me, you see.
All-knowing.
Yeah, well, yes.
All right.
Well, that's what you've got to do if you're going to write a book. It takes terrific nerve, really, to write a book, or to feel that you are in charge of your characters, or are a fit person to tell your reader what to think, feel, and believe.
Nerve?
Well, yeah, if you think about it, it's you don't get humble people writing novels, do you?
Oh, I don't know. I think you get humble writing them. You get less humble when they're published, though.
Oh, I don't know. No, I think if you're going to set out to write a novel, it means you have you think you know what you're doing, and you think you've got something to say, and you think you have a vision of the world which you it would be good for readers to at least observe, but as I say, not necessarily agree.
Well, Faye Weldon, you certainly have had a lot to say over the years with I was looking at the many books that you have written and plays and nonfiction books. Let's go back to the Fat Woman's Joke. That was your first book. Tell me a little bit about how that book started and what kicked off your career as a writer.
Well, I was a young woman with living through hard times and with babies and nobody to support them and trying to earn a living. And I was working in an advertising agency trying to pay the rent. And I started writing television plays. And I started off writing television commercials, that's it. And then was waiting for a baby to be born. By that time, I was kind of married and settled, I may say, and had nothing to do, so I wrote a television play, television drama, which I don't think you have over here particularly as the form that we did in the UK. And it was performed, made, done, and that was the Fat Woman's, a television drama called The Fat Woman's Tale. But I had to write it, as you do with television, to size. Bits had to be taken out of it for reason of time. And because in those days I believed that every word I said was sacred and must somehow last forever, which is what new young writers do often feel, I thought I'd better turn it into a novel. And over which you have total control, because you can describe your characters, you can describe their reactions, you can describe the sets. You don't have to be in the hands of a designer or a director or a cast. Didn't I realize you had total control? So I turned it almost word for word into a novel, which was, as they say, well received. It was a feminist novel, that is to say, it was in the early days of feminism. It was about the situation of women, which in a way, 20 years ago, was not made apparent in the novels or plays of the time, or very seldom. We've come an amazing way in the last 20 years on both sides of the Atlantic. We now make women central to fiction. They used always to be on the sidelines. It is still sometimes surprising for viewers or readers when they discover that the woman acts and the man reacts, which is what happens in my fiction. Normally, if you look carefully at what you're seeing or reading, men act, women react. It's quite, still sometimes seems quite startling. But I was brought up in an all-women household, and my mother kept us, and my mother supported my grandmother and my sister and myself, and the very few men ever visited us, and I believed that I'm sure we must have come about somehow, I believed the world was female, and it was only when I went to college and discovered that it was male and that men ran it that I began to see what it was really like. And I don't think I ever got over my astonishment at discovering that men ran the world. And so the fiction that I write is, I think, due to this early upbringing, about women. That is, women are central to it. It doesn't strike me as strange at all.
No, it doesn't strike me as strange either. And traditions do have a way of being shattered. It takes a long time. The pill helped to shatter them, and women who learn to assert themselves, go to college and do the same things that the men can do. It's changed everything, and it's still in the process of changing, but
it is,
but you can see it. And in fact, in the publishing industry in the United States, the major publishers are run by women.
Oh, yes, that is true. Go to Europe, though, and it's the rest of Europe, apart from the UK, and it's quite different. It is still a male bastion. The reviewers are all men. The novelists for men, women still have a very hard time, but it shifts. I mean, the danger over here, I think, is and in London, is that novels and the publishing of fiction becomes almost a female ghetto and will lose status because women do it, not men.
Are you saying publishing has become a female ghetto?
It is in danger, I think, of becoming a female ghetto.
Because it's shifted too much.
Because it's shifted. Well, perhaps it hasn't shifted too much, but it has certainly shifted.
Many of the great editors are women today. I have an editor who happens to be a woman who bought a book that I wrote some time ago. And many of the great editors and people who are in charge of the money are women. And but it is your observation is well taken. Maybe it is shifting dangerously to become a woman's occupation, like nursing.
And teaching, and then it becomes a lowly paid.
When you were growing up, what kind of household did you have? Was there some inkling in your childhood that you would become a writer?
I was brought up in New Zealand, and yes, I suppose so. My mother earned her living by writing quite a lot of the time when she could. My grandfather was a writer, my uncle was a writer. So, although I didn't meet that part of the family because they were in England and I was in New Zealand, it was just in the air that writing was how sensible people earned a living. So I did.
Sensible people earn a living from writing? Not in this country.
Well, the kind of people you like to have around and talk to. Not the kind that are necessarily going to make millions.
But in college, didn't you study economics?
I did economics and psychology, yes I did. Well, I was good at it.
Did you ever apply it?
Always. Let us not say I haven't lived most of my life in debt, not in that sense, but at least you can read the papers sensibly. And you more or less know what's going on. But it was a very obscure and abstruse kind and theoretical kind of economics that I did. I knew nothing about, and still don't, the working of the stock exchanges, but I did know all about supply and demand. And
did you study writing at all?
No, I was very bad at that. Failed literature exams. I could never do them. You would be asked what the writer meant, and I couldn't understand what they wanted me to say, because it seemed to me the writer said exactly what he wanted to say, no more, no less, and that was it. So I would stare blankly, and they would mark me badly. So I gave up all that.
How does one become a writer? How does one learn to do it? Is it by reading other people's work, or just sitting down to do it, or what?
You do it. You do it. I think you do actually have to have a kind of you have to have some kind of response to words, I think. Otherwise, you had better not try. And that, I do believe, though it's very unfashionable to believe it, is genetically determined. Some people can paint, which we all accept. Some people are musical, which we all accept. Some people can express some kind of vision that they have through language. But so unless you have that talent, you can work and work and it'll come to no good. If you have the talent and you don't work and work, then it comes to no good just the same. So
that's John Fowle's belief, isn't it, that being able to write is genetic?
Yes, it's not popular because we like to think that if you just try hard enough, you can do anything you want. But it's not true. I mean, I could try to play the clarinet, but I reckon I probably couldn't. I certainly wouldn't be on the world stage, as it were, as a clarinet player, no matter how hard I worked. But it's the same with writing. But of course, because we can all write letters or learn to write at school, we believe we have learned, and that there is going to be no difference between me and the my accountant. No, of course it's like that. I still think people should try. I think that I'm a great proselytizer in fiction. I do. It is important. I do think that people read it, because how else are you going to know what it's like to be another person? Because it is only through fiction, really, that you learn how the rest of the world operates.
I missed that.
Well, it's only through the reading of fiction, or the watching of television, or of drama, or stage, that we know what it feels like to be another person. It teaches us empathy. I think to try to write stories is very important for everybody. To read them aloud to their families is a good occupation. It makes you work at what it's like to be another person. Now, there could be nothing wrong with this. You don't need all that much talent, really, to do it. I know there are a lot of people have talent, but don't do anything with it. And a lot of people write novels and stories and put them in their bottom drawer instead of doing what they should do, which is send them out into the world to take their chance with a publisher, and so they'll probably come back. So what does it matter?
That's a very interesting point about learning about other people. I think one of the worst criticisms of a biography of a famous person is when the critic will say, well, we found out everything we know, everything that you can know about this person, his birth, his parents, his job, his exploits, but we don't know anything about him.
No. What were you to read a novel based on that life, you would know a great deal more. You'd never know everything, but you would know much more what it felt like to be that person, not just looked at from the outside, what they did and said and what documents passed between them and their publisher or whoever. It is very important. It's not, I do think, really, as the world, not just this part of it, is increasingly obsessed by fiction, and we're hardly aware of it. But if you think of a program like Dallas, it's seen in the remotest parts of the world, yeah, mountain passes and in submarines and in Papua New Guinea. They're all watching Dallas. It is most extraordinary, both sort of unifying thing that can happen and also rather bizarre, because we're not pretending really that Dallas is real life. It's not necessarily the highest form of fiction, and yet there it is, without any safeguards almost as at all, beaming out all over the world.
Well, to kind of wrap things up, although I could sit here, I know, and talk to you for hours, but I know we both have schedules to follow, but to kind of wrap things up, I wanted to ask you, you've been involved in the Booker Prize, which I understand is England's top literary prize. And in this country, there has been a lot of criticism of the way some of these prizes are awarded, and there have been a lot of political associations to the awarding of these prizes. I think Larry Heineman won the National Book Award last year, and he came from nowhere. And people said, why? Why? When there were famous people who could have gotten this prize. So the question is, I'm not even sure prizes are fair. It's a wonderful thing to have it and to get an award, but how do you do it? I mean, how can you compare one writer to another when most writing of fiction is so different?
Well, of course prizes aren't fair, but I don't think anybody would ever suggest that they were. And I do in fact quite a lot of judging, and it's always extraordinary, though, the unanimity there is about a good piece of work, whether it's tragedy or funny or light or serious, but of its kind, things are sometimes just excellent, and you can tell. It's a kind of instinct that everybody seems to have, which is they can tell the best, and that in a way is what you do. Now, whether the right range is coming to you, you don't know, and of course political considerations enter in. That is to say, if you're me, you will want somehow to give the prize to somebody who hasn't had a prize before, or somebody who isn't famous, because quite often people become famous simply by being very boring, or because people don't like to criticize, you see, because then they think they lack literary judgment. But you can be sort of and feel by their nature iconoclastic. Well, that again is almost a danger if you insist on not giving prizes to the great and the famous, but only to the unknown. Literary prizes are very good for the book trade. They're good for publishers. I think they're bad for writers. If you take something like the Booker Prize, which is one writer a year, and a large sum of money is dangled before their nose, and then taken away from everybody else, it's a humiliating and terrible experience. I think it's also in a way bad for readers. They may indeed read this particular book, and they will read that particular book because they think it has been given some kind of authority, because a group of people who are supposed to know what they're doing say that's an okay novel to read, and people are very nervous of their own judgment, and that kind of recommendation is valuable. But it also too does give to readers a sense that writers are people who write for literary prizes, that is, they write for fame and fortune, and we don't you see. We really don't. You write because you have a kind of, some sort of vision of the universe, and you wish to somehow focus it on the page through the written word in a fictional form, and you try to get it right. And that is, and then because you have to live and eat and pay the rent, it goes out into the world, and publishers publish it, and with any luck, it will make you a lot of money. But that's, or indeed make your name. But that isn't why you do it. And increasingly, you find readers believe that it is your ambition to write a bestseller. You're extremely happy if you write a bestseller, but that's not what, if you have any dignity or any sense of literary style, that is not what you set out to do, nor do you set out to please your critics.
Well, my last question is rather related to what you just said. Do you have any advice to people who are listening and want to write, but don't know how or haven't been able to do it up to this point?
Well, you get this bit of paper, and if you're me, you get a pen, you don't get a typewriter or a word processor or anything. You take up, as it were, not quite what God gave you, but what is to hand. That is a bit of paper and a pencil, or a pen, preferably, and you work out what it is you think, or you believe, or you want to say, and then, or what your particular vision is, or some things, even some feeling or thought that you may be slightly ashamed of, or that nobody around you understands, or would understand if you were to say it, and yet it seems you're important. And then you people it with characters, and you give them a story, or a plot, or indeed your idea might be the story. I mean, it's always different. And you start at the beginning, and as you start, you will realize the difficulties, and you will solve the difficulties as you go along. And if you come to an end after three chapters, which many people do, it's not because you're stuck, it's because you've finished. Now, what you do then is to go back to your beginning. You either give it up because you've finished and try again, but you haven't set yourself a sufficient task to do at the beginning. This is what you learn as you go on writing, in fact, how to set it up properly at the beginning to save yourself a lot of
Well, that sounds easy enough.
Simple. Anyone can do it.
Faye Weldon, thank you very much.